Hello, this is your volunteer broadcaster, Cicely Tiernan, bringing you the September 1st edition of the New Yorker magazine. Today's main story is how a billionaire owner brought turmoil and trouble to Sotheby's by Sam Knight. A reporter at large, how a billionaire owner brought turmoil and trouble to Sotheby's. Patrick Drahi made a fortune through debt-fueled telecommunications companies. Now he's bringing his methods to the art market, by Sam Knight. When Patrick Drahi, a 55-year-old French-Israeli telecommunications billionaire, agreed to buy Sotheby's, one of the world's two great auction houses, early in the summer of 2019, people in the art market had two questions: who is Drahi, and what does he want? On a superficial level, buying an auction house is the kind of thing that French billionaires do. Christie's arrival of Sotheby's since the 1760s has been owned by François Pinault, a French luxury goods magnate and prolific art collector, for the past quarter century. A former banker who worked with Drahi described the acquisition to me as an heirloom. "Think about your obituary," he said. "Are you likely to be recalled for having done many cable deals or having owned Sotheby's?" But Drahi, who had a net worth of around $8 billion, seemed to come out of nowhere. Although a spokesperson described him as a connoisseur with an encyclopedic knowledge of classical music and paintings particularly, he wasn't considered a major player in the art market. Art Price, a French art sale database, reportedly listed Drahi as the 252nd biggest art collector in the world. Moreover, unlike Pinault and Bernard Arnault, another French luxury goods billionaire who used to own Phillips, an auction house that, like Sotheby's and Christie's, was founded in London in the 18th century, Drahi did not seem eager for a public profile. Whereas Pinault and Arnault were household names in France and had major foundations, Drahi was more elusive, dividing his time among Switzerland, Israel, and the Caribbean nation of Nevis. "He is not in Paris, he is not in New York, he is not in London," a person close to Drahi said. "He is not where his counterparts are. He is not spending a single minute of any cocktail or public event." Sotheby's was also unlike any other company that Drahi had ever owned. Between them, Sotheby's and Christie's conduct about 20% of global art sales, $10 to $15 billion a year, but they are, in many ways, esoteric organizations. Employees, dealers, and art advisors liken the duopoly to a pair of medieval guilds or sports teams, or theater companies doomed and inspired in equal measure by a state of permanent competition. People feel such a connection to the company, one longtime Sotheby's employee who recently left the auction house said. "For many of them, it's just so much of their whole lives. And putting together an auction, it's like putting on the big school play." Until then, Drahi had done business almost exclusively in the telecommunications sector. He was the founder and main shareholder of Altice, an international cable, TV, broadband, and mobile phone provider that was named for a sacred grove in ancient Greece. He had a reputation as a formidable dealmaker with uncanny confidence in his own judgment. "He doesn't think outside the box," the Drahi associate said. "He thinks there is no box." A former telecom banker who worked on several transactions, including Drahi, in the early 2000s, chose three adjectives to describe him: 1, smart; 2, aggressive; 3, utterly unsentimental. Drahi has been referred to as a wizard of debt. "He has built, since day one, all of his companies with debt," the associate said. His appetite for risk meant that Altice's fortunes and his own could dramatically fluctuate. But he seemed to thrive rather than wilt during such situations. "He likes it. He likes it," the associates said, as if to emphasize Drahi's unusual fortitude. The first banker told me, "Very rarely do you find people that are able to master the numbers, but also the brinksmanship," adding, "You could say, well, what for? But you know, that's a Nietzschean question." The Drahi takeover valued Sotheby's at $3.7 billion. Employees got their first glimpse of the new owner at an all-staff town hall at the company's New York headquarters on York Avenue in early October 2019, on a day that the deal was finalized. The meeting took place in the main sales room on the seventh floor and consisted of a question and answer session with Tad Smith, the company's chief executive. Smith, a former CEO of Madison Square Garden, was an assiduous, somewhat robotic character who had been appointed 4.5 years earlier to modernize the auction house, which was the oldest company listed on the New York Stock Exchange. For years, it had been axiomatic among Sotheby's employees that the auction house would benefit from having a single rich proprietor, as Christie's did. Looking back, I realized Tad was brought in to sell the company, a former senior executive told me. The last private owner of Sotheby's was Alfred Taubman, a charismatic Midwestern mall developer who bought the auction house in the early 80s and helped to transform it into a glamorous retail experience. Taubman was later convicted of colluding with Christie's to fix pricing and spent 10 months in prison, but he is still fondly remembered at Sotheby's as a pioneer of the modern art market. In person, however, Drahi did not make a big impression. He was not an Alfred Taubman. He's not a larger-than-life person. He's just the opposite, the longtime Sotheby's employee said. I found him a little geeky. Drahi emphasized that he was buying the auction house for his family. Within days of the deal going through, all four of his children were given Sotheby's email addresses. He stressed his admiration for the Sotheby's brand, but he also warned that the company would be run differently from now on. "I make quick decisions," another former executive recalled him saying. "Most of the time they're right, sometimes they're wrong, and if they're wrong, we fix them. But I don't like getting stuck in the past." I don't think anyone was terrified, but they certainly weren't reassured, the former executive said. Drahi's previous acquisitions were associated with brutal restructurings and often declining levels of service. In the French media, Drahi was caricatured as a cost killer. Soon after Altice bought the New York-based cable company Cablevision, he told a conference, "I don't like to pay salaries. I pay as little as I can." In 2017, Drahi gave a speech that was broadcast to employees around the world. "If you want the comfort and stability of a large bureaucracy," he said, "Altice is not for you." In early private meetings with Sotheby's senior staff, Drahi came across as highly intelligent but also caustically blunt. "He just says whatever he's thinking," the former senior executive said. Another recalled, "He walked in like he knew the business and what he needed to do." A third described their meeting as perplexing. He kind of philosophized and then asked a couple of questions that seemed really out of left field. A fourth executive warned Drahi that he would face resistance if he tried to change the company too fast. He said, "That's fine," the executive recalled. "I don't mind breaking things." Drahi confided that he thought that the auction house employed too many people and that its senior staff were overpaid. But when he was asked at the town hall whether he was planning any layoffs, he said that he didn't think so. "All I was thinking was, wow," a fifth executive said. "They are poring over the company right now, looking for cost reductions." During the creation of his telecom business, Drahi was admired for his ability to see where the industry was going. "He was really good at managing the cycle," the former banker said. "Most people will borrow at the wrong time, buy at the wrong time. He seemed to be able to get it right." In the fall of 2019, the stock price of Altice USA was around $30 a share. The global art market was enjoying a long resounding boom. The most expensive artwork sold at auction that year was Muse, a haystack painting by Claude Monet, which was bought for $110 million at a Sotheby's evening sale in New York. The longer you spend buying it, the longer you'll spend enjoying it, the auctioneer Harry Delmane urged bidders. But the timing of Drahi's acquisition of Sotheby's was unfortunate. 6 months after the deal was completed, the coronavirus pandemic shuttered the art market. The main auction houses, led by Sotheby's, scrambled to take their business online, but public sales fell by around a third. Then, for a while, the good times roared back. But now the art market has become a stressed and anxious realm, enduring its first prolonged contraction in a generation. During the same period, Drahi's broader business empire has experienced the worst crisis of his career. After amassing $60 billion of debt, Altice was hit by rising interest rates while seeing indifferent performance by its brands on both sides of the Atlantic. In the summer of 2023, one of Drahi's closest business partners was arrested following a corruption investigation. Altice USA shares currently trade for around $2.50, less than a tenth of their price in 2019. All the while, Sotheby's has assumed a new, unstable identity as both a billionaire's indulgence and the subject of his latest corporate experiment. At a hearing in the French Senate in 2022, Drahi said he did not buy Sotheby's for power or influence. Instead, he intended to triple the value of his investment. This is always the goal of the entrepreneur, he said. For those caught up in the experiment, it has been toward in the extreme. Since 2019, hundreds of employees have left Sotheby's, up to a quarter of the workforce, according to some estimates, including dozens of specialists who bring in the consignments essential to the company's bottom line. Sotheby's disputes this. Last year, sales fell by 23%. As the auction house has cut costs and shed staff, its holding company, which is controlled by Drahi, has extracted more than $1 billion in dividends from the business, mainly to manage its debt load. Last fall, after a round of layoffs, Drahi sold a minority stake in Sotheby's, close to a third of the company, to ADQ, the Abu Dhabi Sovereign Wealth Fund, for around $1 billion. The move gave rise to speculation that he might sell the business outright, but people close to Drahi insist that he is more likely to give up his telecom holdings, at least in Europe, than to let go of Sotheby's. This is for his grandchildren, the associate said. The question is what he will leave behind. Drahi and his team wouldn't be the first or the last corporate titans to trip and stumble in the vagaries of the art market. This is niche, a leading New York art advisor told me. And if you don't get it, this is what happens. They're not art people, and maybe they can never be art people. But the other version is what Drahi is deliberately hollowing out, one of the world's great auction houses, turning it from an institution of taste and knowledge into something much closer to a generic platform that sets a price for things that have no price, taking a cut along the way. To make Sotheby's more like everything else, in other words, I think if he could automate this business, just put it online, take out all the people, that's his goal, a former director said. It's just pure money. But was it ever about anything else? The world auction comes from the Latin "atico," which means increase, but it's always been a bit more complicated than that. In the 5th century BCE, Herodotus described the Babylonian custom of selling girls for marriage. The more attractive ones were sold first, with ascending bids. Then the process was turned on its head, with the plainest won by the suitor, who would accept the smallest dowry. Auctions can be as varied as human desire. There are whispered auctions in Italy and simultaneous yelling auctions in Japan. For years, cod was sold in the fish market in Hull, in northern England, by describing birds, the Dutch method, before switching to English or ascending bids later in the day. 17 miles downriver in Grimsby, fish auctions worked the other way around. In 193 CE, the Roman Empire was sold to the highest bidder, one Marcus Didius Julianus, giving rise to a memorable case of buyer's remorse. He passed a sleepless night, revolving most probably in his mind his own rash folly, Edward Gibbon reflected. Emperor Julianus was murdered 2 months later. Auctions are built on an illusory symmetry of hope. Buyers sense a bargain, sellers hope for a war. What you want is validated because someone else wants it too. Everyone believes in their own capacity to master the situation. In 1662, Samuel Pepys, the London diarist, watched three ships auction by the candle the length of time it took a 1-inch candle to melt, and noticed that one bidder was particularly successful. He told me that just as the flame goes out, the smoke descends, which is a thing I never observed before, and by that he do know the instant when to bid last. The task of the auctioneer is to dramatize the possibilities of the sale while attempting to control them at the same time, to get the audience's confidence right away, and after that to dominate it in the nicest way possible. Peter Wilson, a legendary Sotheby's chairman, told this magazine in 1966. Wilson, a former British intelligence officer, led the company's expansion into the US market and introduced the first evening sales with ball gowns and television cameras in the 50s. Even today, when people complain that much of the excitement of live bidding has disappeared, sales rooms at major auction houses retain a singular atmosphere of politesse and extortion. Money is present like sin in church. Sometimes its presence goes unsaid, sometimes it is the only thing being said. One Tuesday in early March, I stopped at Sotheby's modern and contemporary evening auction in London. The equivalent sale in 2023 brought in more than $200 million and was led by Wassily Kandinsky Landscape that sold for $45 million. This year, the top lot was a large hypnotic study of a girl, Cosmic Eyes in the Milky Lake, by the Japanese artist Yoshitomo Nara, with an estimate of less than a quarter of that. The mood was brittle and unsure. Earlier in the day, tariffs imposed by President Donald Trump had unnerved global markets. A few minutes before the auction began, the walls were lined with Sotheby's specialties, arranged sharply by the phones, while people in cashmere and expensive anoraks milled about. Oliver Barker, the company's star auctioneer of the past decade, tucked in his shirt. Barker always looks happiest when the bidding was in a new place, which means that a fresh competitor has entered the fray. The rest of the time, he is more like a solicitous but firm personal trainer, asking for one more rep. "Give me six, please, Alex," he said, not really, asking to Alex Brenciak, a chairman of Modern and Contemporary Art, who was wrangling the Nara's lead bidder over the phone. Barker wanted another 100,000 pounds. "It's here at 6,500,000," Barker said. "Want to give me six?" Barnciak gave him six. There were outbreaks of what the auction houses like to call determined or even passionate bidding. Lisa Bryce's After Emba, a bold reddish mise en scene featuring a silhouette of Nicki Minaj, sold for 4.4 million pounds, a record for the artist. A Dirk Albert Bury Sacainero III from 1955 shot through its high estimate from £4 million. But most of the contests were thin and quick. A Van Gogh drawing once owned by Taubman, much loved at Sotheby's here, Barker said, sold on a single bid for less than its estimate. "Give me a bid, sir," Barker pleaded, dropping the bid increments as he attempted to shift a large gray Christopher wool canvas on the wall to his right. Again, Barker extracted a single offer, and again below the estimate. The wool was sold in 51 seconds. In all, the evening sale, Sotheby's first major auction of 2025, raised a little more than £60 million, including fees, around 40% less than the previous year. Even people intimately involved with the big auction houses can't figure out whether they are great or terrible businesses these days. Given that Sotheby's charges a buyer's premium, essentially a commission of 27% on all lots up to $1 million, and often a seller's fee on top, the margin should be tremendous. It's never not been profitable, a longtime employee insisted. It's just that the profits are so much harder to come by. At the height of the 80s art boom, Sotheby's made an annual profit of $113 million. 25 years later, in 2014, at the peak of the next wave, the auction house made just $29 million more, the price of a mid-range Basquiat. Part of the problem is the sheer expense of keeping the show on the road. Sotheby's and Christie's feel fancy because they are. Sotheby's has premises in 40 countries. At the time of the Drahi acquisition, it employed more than 1,500 people. The cost of parties, marketing, shipping insurance, and the decorous administration of nearly 500 sales a year only ever drifts one way. You basically make profit in December, a Paris-based art advisor who used to work for one of the big two told me. Until November, you pay the fixed costs of the company. A major auction house has many parts. Sotheby's is really three businesses, which had been run as one business, a former employee who joined under Tad Smith told me. Since the late 80s, Sotheby's has offered loans and other financial products secured against art. In fact, anything that the auction house will sell as collateral. When Drahi acquired the company, Sotheby's Financial Services was lending around $800 million a year. Next, there is everything under $1 million in value. The wine, the jewelry, the furniture, the sneakers, the watercolors, the Hermès handbags. These are the collectibles. A nice watch, a decent painting, a rare manuscript, the family silver, that have kept the auction houses ticking for the better part of the three centuries. The average price of a Sotheby's lot is still around $50,000. And then there is the top end, and the top end is where everything goes to hell. According to the consulting firm Art Economics, less than 0.5% of works sell for more than $1 million, and yet these lots make up more than half the total revenue of fine art auctions. An even smaller fragment, sales of more than $10 million, contribute around a quarter. Sourcing sensational objects to sell has been the central mission of Sotheby's since Samuel Baker offered several hundred scarce and valuable books in all branches of polite literature in the house's first recorded auction in March 1744. It is the motivating mission of the specialists, hundreds of experts in everything from Judaica to barometers, whiskey to Himalayan art, who are the primary business getters for the company. But the unstopping competition between the big two auction houses, especially in the realm of fine art, has put extraordinary power into the hands of the people who have those things to sell. Everything's on the table. Richard Polsky, an art authenticator in New Mexico, who has helped to negotiate major sales at both Sotheby's and Christie's, told me, "If you have a great painting by an artist who's in heavy demand, they'll do anything for you. It's crazy, but they will, and they often lose by doing anything." It's almost like a concert rider, the former Sotheby's executive said. Routine requests have included putting a photo of the art on the front cover of the auction catalog with a scholarly-looking essay about it inside. Other asks might include a traveling exhibition or a facsimile made of the original. Seasoned consignors want propitious placement in the sale, near the start but not too near. Works just before the start lots often have low estimates to encourage bidding and to improve the atmosphere in the room. Important sellers often request Barker as their auctioneer. And that's before you get to the substantive negotiations. Top sellers won't pay a seller's fee. They probably want a minimum guarantee. If the bidding goes higher, they will split the upside with the auction house or a third-party guarantor. Or they might prefer a portion, even the majority, of the buyer's premium, the basic income of the auction house, an arrangement known as an enhanced hammer. And if they don't get what they want, they will go down the road to another place. You're trying to squeeze every dollar out of these guys, Polsky said, and you don't feel bad doing it. Some of these bespoke terms go back decades. In June 1956, according to Rogue's Gallery by Philip Hook, Wilson offered a presale guarantee of £35,000 for Nicolas Poussin's The Adoration of the Shepherds in order to break the grip of London's private dealers on the sale of old masters. Sometimes the bet pays off, sometimes it misfires. Sotheby's lost £6,000 on the Poussin, but the relentless increase in the value of the most expensive artworks, frequently engineered by the auction houses themselves, has meant that negotiations with consigners has become only more vexed. The objects that everyone so desperately wants to put on in the salesroom have become, in a real sense, too expensive to make money from. Essentially, in order to win business, you're throwing out the baby with the water of the bath, the French advisor said. I would say, for the longest time, the profitability of something was not on the minds of the specialists chasing after things, a former Sotheby's chairman told me. The top-rated specialists are known as chairmen. In 2015, Dan Loeb, an activist shareholder, led a revolt against the company's then-CEO, a rug expert named William Ruprecht, describing Sotheby's as an old master painting in need of restoration. Smith, who had an MBA from Harvard, was installed as his replacement. Smith accelerated the breathtakingly slow digitization of the auction house. Sotheby's didn't have a Facebook account until 2011. He upgraded the company's technology, introducing an online auction platform, codenamed Viking, at a cost of some $50 million. In 2016, Sotheby's acquired Art Agency Partners, an art advisory firm led by Amy Capolazzo, a former chairman of post-war and contemporary art development at Christie's, to minimize its margins at the top end of the market. Under Smith, Sotheby's became more mercantile and more systematic, but it didn't always make better bets or have a deeper understanding of what it was selling. The temperature change, a specialist who worked in the contemporary department at the time told me. Things got very tight, and people became much more concerned with how much they were bringing in and how much they were selling. Dozens of employees, including veteran experts, took buyouts and left. Clients and dealers registered a diminished emphasis on connoisseurship and its replacement by what is sometimes referred to as collector's taste, a phenomenon not limited to Sotheby's. A London dealer told me that he recently visited the house of a client who, instead of naming the artist of his paintings, labeled them by where they were acquired. Gagosian, Zerner, Christie's, like they were designer loafers. In the spring of 2018, Sotheby's lost money on a $36 million Picasso and barely broke even on a $138 million Mogdalini. In the years leading up to the Drahi takeover, during the greatest art market in the world had ever seen, the company's stock zigzagged around $36 a share, the same level that it had been in 2010. It was the Romans, auctioneers of their own empire, who came up with the job titles for the people involved. Dominus, the seller, Argentarius, the organizer, Emptor, the buyer, Caveat emptor, buyer beware. No one knows how much Drahi understood about what he was buying in 2019. I could truly think he bought Sotheby's thinking, this is run the old-fashioned way by a bunch of morons who know about art but don't know about finance, the French advisor said. I think he felt that Sotheby's was completely virgin of all that. And it's not true. It's a super, super thin business. François de Mersers, the mayor of Versailles, encountered the work of Drahi in 2007. It was when ivory-colored cabinets started appearing on street corners in the Versailles Grand Parc, a collection of 18 upscale districts west of Paris. The cabinets were for broadband connections and belonged to Numersable, a recently formed cable company. At the time, Europe's telecom industry was in a phase of creative destruction, as upstarts and established companies made bets on which technology wireless cable or ADSL, a form of data transmission through existing telephone lines, would best deliver the internet. Drahi, who had a postgraduate degree from Télécom Paris, one of the country's top engineering schools, was a cable guy. You're listening to The New Yorker magazine on Sun Sounds of Arizona, read by your volunteer broadcaster, Cicely Tiernan. Starting in 2002, he had begun to acquire small regional cable companies with the aim of building a national network. In 2005, Altice, with a group of private equity investors, paid 528 million euro for the assets that became Numera Cable. Mezières didn't have a grasp of the finer points of the telecom industry, but he did notice one thing about the new cabinets. They were made of plastic. They were of such bad quality you could kick them open with your foot, he told the French journalist Elsa Bembarren for her 2017 book, The Network Ogre, about Drahi. The wires were visible. In a town like Versailles, it was unacceptable. Drahi prided himself on doing things more cheaply than his rivals. A large group counts in millions, I count in cents, he liked to say, according to Bembarren. In the sleepy world of French regional telecommunications, his methods could be shocking. After another acquisition in 2006, one of Drahi's companies found itself the object of simultaneous protests by its customers and its employees. There was an outsider swagger to some of Drahi's behavior. He had spent his life by being the challenger, the associate said. Drahi was born in Casablanca, Morocco, in 1963. His parents, Lucette and Marcel, were math teachers from Algeria. The family, which was Jewish, moved to Montpellier in southern France, when Drahi was 15. According to Bembarren, he was small and somewhat conspicuous because of his North African upbringing and his head for math. Between 2002 and 2013, Altice acquired 20 companies. For a long time, Drahi ran the corporate affairs of Numer Cable, which had around 4 million customers in France, and out of an apartment in Geneva. When he had to conduct a news conference for Numer Cable in Paris, he would reportedly use the basement of an electronics store on the Avenue de Friedland near the Arc de Triomphe. He designed Altice's logo himself. In the spring of 2014, Drahi bought SFR, France's second-largest cell phone network, in a deal that was ultimately worth 17 billion euro. The negotiations made Drahi a figure of national attention. He was attacked for his management style and his residency in Switzerland, which he maintained for tax reasons. I was suspicious, Arnaud Montebourg, the French Minister of Industrial Renewal at the time, told me. In person, however, Montebourg found Drahi to be charming and impressive. I knew he knew how to do a restructure, Montebourg recalled. But I said, be careful, I don't want blood on the walls. Drahi promised unions that there would be no job cuts as SFR for 3 years. Sana Ifac, a commercial manager at the company, remembered meeting him in the fall of 2014. Ifac was in a conference room with about 10 colleagues when Drahi walked in and asked why a projector screen on the wall was on, wasting energy. He made them switch it off. Drahi was accompanied by a man whom he did not introduce. Ifac wondered whether he was Drahi's driver. She later learned that he was Armand Piera, a former subcontractor from Portugal who ran the operational side of Altice. Like Drahi, Pierre was entirely self-made. By the age of 13, he had worked as a fairground assistant and a plumber, later immigrating to France. In the 80s, Pierre founded his own telecom subcontracting firm in the Vosges. He and Drahi started working together in Caveiran, a Provençal town famous for its melons, where Pierre's company installed connections for Sud Cable Services, one of the Drahi's first cable ventures. Pierre became a co-founder of Altice, and although he shunned publicity, his technical know-how was understood to be a critical part of the company's success. Pierre was seen to be an exceptionally good operator, the former banker told me. Ifach got used to seeing Drahi and Pierre at SFR's headquarters, normally at the end of the week. She and her colleagues started calling their visits Dark Fridays, riffing on the weekly eliminations on Koh-Lanta, the French equivalent of Survivor. Within a month of Altice's acquisition of SFR, 55 of its 70 top managers had been fired, according to Ben Baron. Once the moratorium on cutting jobs passed, SFR announced plans to eliminate 5,000 roles, around a third of the workforce. Drahi later compared the company to a daddy's girl who didn't look at her credit card receipts. But today, the father has changed, and my daughter doesn't behave like that, he told French legislators. One of the ways SFR changed was by delaying payments to its suppliers. Usually you have one case, two cases, 10 cases. Pierre Pelloze, a mediator who was appointed by a union of French IT companies to collect unpaid invoices from SFR, told me. But 100 companies coming together, it's fairly unusual. When Ifach arrived for work one morning on March 2018, there were notices stuck to SFR's front entrance from its water supplier, warning of reduced flow to the building because of unpaid bills. The Drahi method is, I pay you 30% less, she said. Financiers sometimes laughed at the brazenness of Drahi's methods. They told investors that this is what they were going to do, Jonathan Chaplin, a telecom analyst, said. Everyone thought they were geniuses. Chaplin began following Altice when it broke into the US market in 2015 by agreeing to buy Cablevision and a year later Suddenlink for a combined total of around $25 billion. It was a period of heady expansion for the company. Altice also bought the former state-owned telecommunications network, Portugal Telecom, where Pierre was installed as chairman. In corporate filings, Altice described its approach to business, which included an aggressive combination of outsourcing and cost-cutting techniques, as the Altice way. The company boasted that its founder-inspired owner-operator culture set it apart from other cable and cell phone businesses in every market that it entered. And it was true that everyone, the Altice way, was everywhere the Altice way was enacted, it looked more or less the same. Suppliers were replaced by cheaper alternatives. Employees were fired and debt rose. It is unclear how successful the Altice way was as a business strategy. Between 2014 and 2016, SFR lost 2 million subscribers. Its share price fell by 45%. Between 2018 and 2022, when Suddenlink was rebranded as Optimum, along with Altice's Cablevision brands, it went from being above average to the worst of 12 internet service providers as ranked by the American Customer Satisfaction Index. But the Altice way was certainly profitable for Drahi and his closest associates. SFR surprised analysts by paying out a 2.5 billion euro dividend to its investors, led by Drahi, a year into his ownership. The Altice way was many things, but it was not free. Drahi used Nextalt, his personal holding company based in Luxembourg, to charge subsidiaries for implementing it and for his own strategic services. Ahead of its IPO in the US in 2017, Altice US disclosed a fee of $30 million a year for executive services to Altice NV, its parent company, which was controlled by Drahi. Altice's brands in Israel and the Dominican Republic contributed a similar amount in 2015. In a speech in Paris about 10 years ago, Ben Baron writes, Drahi talked about which financial indicators he thought were the most important. When analysts talk about operating margin, about EBITDA, a standard measure of business performance, what I look at is the NIP, Drahi said, breaking into English, net in the pocket. In the Altice way reached Sotheby's in the fall of 2019. On October 2nd, the day of the Drahi acquisition, the company was formally split into parts. Sotheby's Financial Services became a subsidiary, as did Bidfair Property Holdings, which would control the auction house's York Avenue headquarters. Another corporate vehicle would hold the company's British properties. Although the auction house was now owned ultimately by Drahi's personal holding company, he contributed only about $250 million in cash to the purchase price. As a result of the deal, Sotheby's debts doubled to more than $1 billion. Drahi insisted that Sotheby's had nothing to do with Altice or the rest of his businesses, but when the takeover was complete, employees at the auction house found themselves in meetings with Dexter Goei, the chief executive of Altice USA. That was very, very strange to me, the former executive recalled. Smith, the CEO, left Sotheby's in late October and was replaced by Charles Stewart, the 49-year-old former co-president and chief financial officer of Altice USA. Stewart was new to the art market, but staff found him smart and personable. Soon after he arrived, he took 50 of Sotheby's most senior employees to the New York Stock Exchange to show them a heritage business that had transformed itself into a global digital trading platform. But people sizing up the incoming regime wondered whether Stewart was really in charge. Charlie's a bit of a figurehead, the former employee said. He likes standing in front of sports cars. The new CEO didn't seem to belong to Drahi's innermost circle, whose members had license to roam across his business interests. You're usually male, French, or Israeli, or all three, the former senior executive said. A spokesperson for Drahi disputed this. Many inside the company came to believe that Drahi's true lieutenant was Jean-Luc Baribi, the company's new CFO who had previously run Drahi's family office. Another curious figure who started working at the York Avenue offices was Yossi Benchtrit, Armando Pierre's son-in-law. At the time, Benchtrit also held two senior roles at Altice USA, the company's head of procurement and its chief programming officer, in charge of negotiating broadcast deals on its cable networks. In the fall of 2019, Benchtrit met with the auction house's suppliers of everything from catalog printings to art, shipping, and software, and sought to renegotiate their contracts. Benchtree had a ponytail and a mild manner. He kind of looked like this aged hippie, the former longtime employee said. Soon afterwards, staff started hearing reports that specialist suppliers to the auction house, such as conservators who repaired damaged paintings, were having to wait longer to get paid. There's only like three people in the world who can do this, one former executive told me. The executive recalled confronting Benchtree about the issue, but he maintained his zen demeanor. He was like, "Who needs to be paid? We have the power. We're Sotheby's," the executive said. Benchtree could not be reached for comment. When COVID hit, Sotheby's was able to adapt quickly, thanks partly to Viking, the online platform developed during the Smith era. On the evening of June 29, 2020, Sotheby's carried out the first white glove sale of the pandemic, ahead of Christie's, with Barker addressing eight screens in Bond Street as he took bids simultaneously in London, New York, Hong Kong, and online. Everybody put their big boy pants on, the longtime employee recalled. Drahi had been an enigmatic presence at the company since the takeover. During lockdown, he joined an all-hands Zoom from his house in Zermatt, Switzerland, with a magnificent view of the Alps behind him, and complained that he was having to iron his own shirts. But he flew to New York for the sale. Drahi stood off camera while a 10-minute bidding contest unfolded over the evening's top lot, Francis Bacon's triptych inspired by the Orestia of Aeschylus, which sold for $84.6 million. "Tonight we redefine the boundaries of what is possible," Barker said. The mood at the auction house was jubilant. In 2020, Sotheby's new management reduced the company's costs by about $100 million. It also renegotiated the compensation of senior staff. The best-paid specialists and executives at Sotheby's earned more than $1 million a year. Previously, around half their income came in the form of bonuses and company stock. But now some of them accepted lower salaries, and many were enrolled in one of the two new long-term incentive programs, which would pay out in 3 or 4 years' time. Senior staff were shown presentations that envisaged Sotheby's rapidly increasing in value as it followed a fresh strategy, which would involve deploying the auction house's name across this range of new businesses, including hotels and sales categories, most notably in the domain of luxury goods. The company already owned a 25% stake in RM Sotheby's, a classic car auction firm. Under Stewart, the stake increased to 75%, and the company's lending business expanded. The incentive program forecasts that, in the best-case scenario, Sotheby's would be valued at more than $8 billion, at least twice what it was worth when Drahi took over. They actually promised people wealth transformation, the specialist said. The company denies this. We were ambitious in our growth agenda, but nothing was ever promised, a spokesperson said. In 2021, Sotheby's secured the Mack Lowe collection, one of the most sought-after auction house consignments in years, with a reported guarantee of more than $650 million. The collection came to market after the divorce of Linda and Harry Mack Lowe, a New York real estate developer, and included masterpieces by Mark Rothko, Jackson Pollock, and Cy Twombly. For Sotheby's, the sale of the collection in two auctions represented the final act of the staggering art bazaar of the 2010s. Bored by the pandemic and awash in stimulus funds, the global rich hit the scene one last time. In 2021, Sotheby's recorded sales of $7.3 billion, the largest in the company's history. It was a high, the former specialist said. The company's dealmakers felt it. Before Drahi, bonuses at Sotheby's had been fairly stable. The only time that senior staff could remember not receiving an annual bonus was during the financial crisis in 2009. In the following years, bonuses typically paid out between 85 and 130% of their target figure. It would never be like something radically different, the employee said. After the Mack Lowe sale, some bonuses were paid out at close to 200%. That was the first moment when people realized, oh, this is really a whole different way of running things, the people recalled. The recalibration of bonuses was part of a larger corporate transformation at Sotheby's. Staff were introduced to the accounting metric EBITDA rather than plum consignments as the determination measure of success. EBITDA is everything for the new Sotheby's, the former executive said. And EBITDA terms, the first 3 years at Drahi's ownership were extremely successful. The auction house was making around $360 million annually, a 40% increase from the latter years of the Tad Smith era. Most employees did not experience it that way. Things were good for like a hot second, the executive said. When the pandemic eased, staff returning to the offices in London noticed a shortage of technicians to look after and mount objects properly. Some works that had previously hung on J-hooks were now hung on wires, which made it harder to put pictures flush against the wall. We were told it was too expensive, a former specialist from a smaller department told me. It just looks shitty and cheap. Marketing budgets, client dinners, trips to Art Basel, the inciting atmosphere of consumption all became harder to come by. For people used to selling art, the cuts represented a paradox of shift that hurt their overall results. Because it's all about relationships, the specialists explained. When you limit the time of people in the sale room in front of the work, you limit that interest, that desire for it, that potential. Employees across Sotheby's Fine Arts division, the historic core of the auction house, noticed a new distance between them and the company's leadership. Compared with their predecessors, Stewart and his executives dramatically reduced the time that they spent with the specialists, who were used to thinking of themselves as the conscience of the business. They created a lot of friction within the organization by not treating the experts as experts, the former specialist said. The New York art advisor told me, you know, these auction house specialists have been kind of relegated to salespeople, which defies the purpose of having a relationship. In the summer of 2021, Capolazzo, the head of the company's global fine art division and the totemic hire of the Smith years, left to set up a new advisory firm. Capolazzo could be domineering. She had her style and her way, a current Sotheby's chairman told me, but she really was a great businesswoman. Her departure gave rise to the sense that the Drahi regime either didn't know how or no longer wanted to work with the company's traditional highly paid stars. That was a radical idea, one of the former executives said. To sum it up, talent doesn't matter when you have a brand as powerful as Sotheby's. That was a profoundly disruptive concept. Another disruptive concept was the rapid ascent of Nathan Drahi, one of Drahi's twin sons, who was appointed to run the company's Asia business at the age of 26. For years, the auction house's Hong Kong office had been a point of pride and stability for the company. It was led by Kevin Cheng, an industry veteran, and Patty Wong, an independently wealthy Hong Kong dealmaker, and it routinely outperformed Christie's in the region. It was one of the pillars of the company's success, the former specialist said. Nathan arrived in Hong Kong in the summer of 2020. His career at Sotheby's was closely watched for signs of Drahi's larger plan for the auction house. Nathan Drahi had no business being anyone's boss in Hong Kong, the New York art advisor said. Cheng's contract was coming to an end, and Nathan was promoted to the managing director in his place. Cheng joined Christie's 2 years later. Almost immediately, reports began to reach New York about Nathan's overbearing management style. His way of disregarding people on every level is staggering, the former specialist said. Nathan sought to interpose himself in sensitive deals despite his lack of experience. He also maintained draconian office policies, such as demanding that all the blinds be constantly raised, sweeping desks clear at the end of the day, and challenging the travel and lunch receipts of senior staff. Literally half of the HR department's job is trying to manage Nathan's damage, the former executive said. Wong left Sotheby's in 2022. In October 2023, Nathan oversaw the sale of the collection of the founders of Shanghai's Long Museum, which came in 40% below its pre-sale estimate of 50 of $95 million, reportedly costing Sotheby's millions of dollars in failed guarantees. The following summer, the auction house opened Sotheby's Maison, a two-story gallery and retail space in the landmark Cheder, a high-end shopping mall. Visiting colleagues were struck by the opulence of the new downstairs galleries, but noted that they were very dark and not well suited to the hanging of Western art. Sotheby's said that the lighting was adjustable. In the upstairs retail space, staff recorded 200 sales in the first 6 months of the Maison operation, slightly more than just one per day. That's madness, the executive said. That could barely even cover the cost of the staff. According to Art Day, an art market analytics company, the auction house's market share declined by 9% during Nathan's time in charge of Sotheby's Asia. Around 10 a.m. on July 13, 2023, Armando Piera, the Altice co-founder, was arrested at the front door of his villa overlooking the village in northern Portugal where he was born. Piera, who was 71, had an estimated net worth of 1.6 billion euro, making him one of the richest men in the country. According to the Portuguese authorities, he was detained along with a businessman named Honoré Vaz Antunes after a 3-year investigation known as Operation Picosas. Picosas is the name of the metro station nearest to Altice Portugal's offices in Lisbon. The investigation centered on Altice procurement contracts, which prosecutors believe Piera had used to enrich himself by funneling business toward particular suppliers. Piera and Antunes were also suspected of diverting money paid by Altice for telecom equipment into another set of companies based in the Madeira Free Trade Zone and in Dubai. Cars worth 30 million euros were seized as part of the investigation, including an Aston Martin and a Lamborghini that were delivered to Piera in the morning of his arrest. Piera was held briefly in a Lisbon jail before being released on a 10 million euro bond. Both Piera and Antunes have denied any wrongdoing. On an earnings call for Altice International on August 7th, Drahi portrayed Piera as a rogue operator who no longer played a key role at the company. He told analysts that if the allegations were true, he had been betrayed and deceived by a small group of individuals, including one of our oldest colleagues. But people familiar with the Altice way wondered whether it was as simple as that. We are not in the presence of a simple shareholder, the Portuguese prosecutor's report said of Piera, but of a de facto director who has the ability to intervene in the decision-making process. Drahi and Piera owned adjacent plots of land on Nevis, and the two men's fortunes were tightly intertwined. On the earnings call, Drahi acknowledged that Piera owned 28% of his personal economic interest. At Altice USA, Ben Chirrut, Piera's son-in-law, helped oversee a budget of around $2 billion a year. And that's all we have time for today. Sam Knight is a London-based staff writer at The New Yorker. His first book is The Premonition Bureau, A True Account of Death Foretold. We are at the conclusion of this week's The New Yorker Magazine program. This is your Sun Sounds of Arizona volunteer broadcaster, Cicely Tiernan. Thank you for tuning in this week, and I invite you to join me next week for another new edition of The New Yorker Magazine. Have a great week and stay tuned to Sun Sounds of Arizona.